В Белоруссии проходят массовые митинги против так называемого
декрета. В соцсетях акцию назвали маршем дармоедов.
Новая волна антиправительственных выступлений в Беларуси.
Участники протеста потребовали отставки Александра.
First, Александр Лукашенко tried the carrot, and then he tried the stick. But neither seemed to be working. Faced with massive protests against an unpopular tax on the unemployed, the Belarusian strongman suspended the tax. And when the protests persisted, Lukashenko turned to his old tried and true methods, arrests and intimidation. But the unfolding crisis in Belarus, driven by economic hardship and declining living standards, is showing no signs of abating. In fact, this week witnessed the largest protest to date. And as the drama in Belarus unfolds, the Kremlin, ever wary of losing another client, is watching attentively. So what happens next? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Alexei Znatkevich of RFRL's Belarus service. Welcome back to the podcast, Alexei. Glad you could make it.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. And joining us on the Skype line from Berlin is Marina Rachlai of the Fund for Belarus Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. Welcome to the podcast, Marina. It's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you for coming. And so we have something of a perfect storm brewing in Belarus. There's an ongoing conflict with Russia over gas prices, oil deliveries, food exports, Belarus granting visa-free travel to Westerners, Russia imposing border controls, and the Kremlin's push for a new airbase. And at the same time, Lukashenko's social contract, which gave the population social welfare in exchange for obedience, is collapsing as living standards plummet. We have mass protests now that the Lukashenko regime seems to have no idea how to deal with it. Alexei, we seem to be in uncharted waters here. I mean, we've not been in this place before. How much trouble is Lukashenko in now?
Well, first, I should say there were much larger protests in the past in Minsk, but nothing so massive outside the capital since 1991. So now there have been protests in every regional center and in quite a few industrial towns. It's hundreds of people, up to several thousand in Homel, so the numbers might not be that impressive, but again, they're probably...
But it's nationwide.
It's the largest scale in the history of independent Belarus outside Minsk. And I think that's an important point, the difference between the regions and the capital. Belarus is a very centralized country, and the resources are concentrated in Minsk. And from what I've seen in our own broadcasts live and from talks with our correspondents who cover the protests, I can say that the protests in Minsk are different so far. There are fewer people who come to protest out of economic desperation, and some of them are coming to the capital from other towns. And I would say this regime still has a lot of resources to suppress the protests in the short run. The talk of near revolution in some of the Western media, I think, is premature. And in the longer run, Lukashenko is indeed in a serious trouble because his system has been based on Russian subsidies and preferences, and those are being cut. And I think Lukashenko really made a big mistake with this presidential decree number 3, which imposed a de facto tax on the unemployed.
Which was the immediate cause of the protest,
which was the trigger. But the real reason was the economic decline, which with GDP contraction during the last several years. But in addition to the purely economic reasons and purely the question of empty pockets, I think it turned out not only economically useless, but also... it was perceived as unjust for many people who supported Lukashenko earlier. And I think justice is very important for Belarusians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and this is certainly something different than we've seen before. We're seeing ordinary Belarusians come out, not the expected usual suspects that come out in Minsk all the time.
But again, outside Minsk, I would say.
And outside of Minsk, and we've not seen anything like this before. Marina, you had a piece this week in which you described the current situation as, quote, quite explosive and definitely dangerous for the current regime. How dangerous do you think this is?
Thank you for this question, Brian. And as we have unfortunately already seen, it's not just me, it's also the regime that believes that this situation is dangerous for itself. That's why, I guess, violent detentions of protesters on the 15th of March and even passers-by were detained and tried. And, I mean, no wonder that the regime views this situation as dangerous. It has been a month of that internet was full of video clips with angry Belarusians. Mm-hmm. And angry Belarusians in itself is an oxymoron, I would say. But the economy is in recession. So the government is poor, but the people are even poorer. So exactly as I guess you mentioned, social contract is void. So people basically took to the streets to show their frustration and anger, as Alexei rightly put it, and they demand changes. Lukashenko was the one saying that I'm ready for reforms, you aren't. So people in the streets are now saying that they are ready for reforms, or at least they're ready for changes that will help, well, they will mend their economic situation. And then the next stress test is the 25th of March, right, when the next big protest will take place, and then the 26th of March for the regions.
The 25th of March, that's Constitution Day, if I'm not mistaken.
No, that's the day when the Belarusian National Republic was announced in 1918, and it's a big date for Belarusian opposition traditionally. So the big question is how many people from the regions and from Minsk will join who would normally not go for this opposition rally.
Now, this leads me to something I wanted to talk about, because Belarusian society is, by tradition and by stereotype and by my observations, and I think yours, quite passive. Marina, as you said, angry Belarusians is kind of a contradiction in terms. Are we witnessing the birth of a Belarusian civil society? Marina, do you see a civil society emerging here?
Well, civil society, you mean something structured that is also not, that is independent from the government. And we know that Belarusian economy is state-controlled. Almost 80% of state and of enterprises are state-owned. So state is an employer of a lot of Belarusians. That's why, I guess, what we're witnessing, what we have been witnessing in the last months was Belarusians trying to demand from their employer that they trying to demand changes from their employer.
But could that lead? Because this is one of the ways that Ukraine and Belarus are very different. Ukraine has this very developed civil society. It's been developing over the past two decades. We haven't seen this process in Belarus, but maybe is it beginning now? Because of the mere fact that so many people are willing to come out on the streets, so many people who are not the usual suspects that are usually that are going out protesting, ordinary people, you see this on the videos that are popping up online. Can this lead to something that we haven't seen in Belarus over the last 25 years?
Yes, absolutely. I believe so. And I would even say that I hope that it's also true, because basically people are ready to take their fate in their own hands and say, well, we're not afraid. We will come up. We will come to the streets and make our demands heard.
Mm-hmm. Alexei, what do you think?
I think it's a little disrespectful to say that there's birth of civil society in Belarus now, because I think there is a civil society in Belarus already. It's weaker than in Ukraine, as you mentioned. But people self-organized after the detentions in the year 2010, and there's been a lot of self-organization in the past years for some social purposes, for some support for children, for some cultural purposes. I think the most important difference, if we compare the two countries, Ukraine and Belarus, is not the difference in their civil societies, but per se, but it's based on the larger gaps in the structure of the executive power and much more centralized and monolithic power and economy. The business is tightly controlled by the state, so the civil society cannot get as much financial support from within the country, and the structures of political parties are very weak. And the power itself, the so-called vertical of power, is very coherent compared to what was happening in Ukraine at the time of the revolution.
Yeah, you've always had a more pluralistic system in Ukraine, even before the revolution.
Right.
And I mean, and so in Ukraine, you had a civil society that had more room to grow, where in Belarus, you had a civil society that didn't have any room to grow. Is this the beginning of the maturing of the Belarusian civil society.
I hope it might become a time of spreading of this civil society, because there was some self-organization of those people who, for example, on a political basis, there was some self-organization after the round of repressions in 2010. And it was quite admirable, but it was limited at that time. It was still wider than before, but I hope it becomes even wider now.
There's another thing related to this, and this is the gap between the rank-and-file protesters, the ordinary Belarusians that are coming out across the country, who are, let's face it, protesting for pocketbook reasons. They're protesting because they want their standard of living to return to what it was before. And then Belarus's traditional opposition, which are not leading these protests, but now they have no choice but to piggyback onto them. And they want political change. They are pro-Western. They want Belarus to turn into a Western-style democracy, is my understanding of the traditional Belarusian opposition. The protesters in the streets don't really care about that in the first instance, it seems to me. Correct me if I'm wrong. The Belarusian opposition is very, and I say nationalist, not in the negative sense, but very patriotic Belarusian, where the rank and file in the streets are more, could be construed as more Russian. Is there a gap here that I'm portraying here, or am I wrong? But if there is a gap, is the gap narrowing?
I think the gap is narrowing in the sense that protesters first blame the authorities for the state of the economy, obviously. And many of them say there should be a change in power at the very top. So the slogan "Lukashenko, go away" has been quite popular in all the current protests, including one in Minsk, where it was more politicized. But the regions picked up on those slogans. And I think those people who, on the one hand, they complain about their economic state, they also share the main point that the changes, the reforms are possible only with the replacement of this government. Like, people were quite radical. The big question is, will these slogans be popular in wider circles? Because we were talking about hundreds of people and maybe a couple of thousands of people, but Gomel, for example, where the largest protest was in the regional city, it's 500,000 people. Uh-huh. So those people who came out, they were ready for change of power. But the big question is how
the wider population.
Wider population.
Marina, what do you think about this gap between the rank and file protesters and the traditional opposition?
I would like to think back to the so-called silent protest in summer 2011, when the economic recession was also pretty bad, and people started taking to the streets every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And these protests were amazingly successful also for the reason that they were not organized by the opposition. Because as soon as you have several opposition parties preparing an event, they have to agree on a slogan,
a manifesto,
and it's not easy. And then there will be people who would say, "No, if Christian Democrats are also there, then I'm not joining." And people, there is a bigger chance that less people will show up if opposition is organizing the protest. On the other hand, protests, to be sustainable and to bear fruit, they do need structure and leaders. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is the chance for civic structures, probably not that much for the opposition, but for the civic structures, especially in the regions, to ride this wave and like draw more people to this movement, and what Alexei was also saying, to hold to this slogan of that the changes are needed, that reforms are needed, and this is now the absolutely common ground between the economic protesters and those who are pro democracy, that all possible groups, they realize that they that change is needed in the country. The status quo is no longer holding.
I just want to come up in defense of the opposition a little bit, because the reason why Gomel protest was the largest among the regional centers, and it was obvious from our live broadcasts as well. You could see that there were leaders, there was some structure, and they had minimal technical things like megaphones, for example. And the reason for that is that there are some structures of the opposition, and not necessarily political parties, but I know that, for example, the Trade Union of Radio Electronics, which is an independent trade union, is quite strong in Homel traditionally, and these people took part in organizing the protests. Mm-hmm. And one of those guys got sentenced today to 10 days in jail, for example. So these people were able to organize, even though people came out without political demands, these people were able to kind of give some structure to the process. And we saw also the opposite in Mogilev and in Vitebsk, where people came out and they had their grievances, but they were not speaking in a unified voice. So,
but then, Alexei, it was also interesting to see that Russia's presence was not visible during the protests, because you could also expect any kind of agent provocateurs who would be who would start shouting slogans that Belarus should become part of Russia.
And there were in Gomel, there were three people who were doing, they were trying to do this, and they were unsuccessful, and people were shouting "Zhivye Belarus" in response. Yeah.
And in Vitebsk, as a matter of fact, as well, but there is no there is no serious attempt on the part of Russia to interfere, to meddle into the this protest movement.
Well, this is because this gets into something else I wanted to get at, and this is the so-called Maidan syndrome. In the years following the Euromaidan revolution in Ukraine, and certainly following the war in the Donbass and the annexation of Crimea, there was this thing that my colleagues describe as the Maidan syndrome in Belarus, this fear on the part of the opposition that if they went into the streets, it would only serve as a potential pretext for Russian intervention. And even if they were successful, even if they pulled off the impossible and overthrew Lukashenko, then they'd have to face another threat from Moscow, because Russia's not going to let Belarus go easy. And this was how a lot of people interpreted the fact that Belarus has been kind of peaceful. There's almost been this peace between Lukashenko and the opposition until now. And he's even made token moves towards the opposition, releasing some political prisoners, allowing a couple of opposition figures to get into the parliament. But this seems to be all off the table. Is the Maidan syndrome over now?
No, I don't think it's over. It depends on who we take again. People who come to protests, especially those outside Minsk, often say they have nothing to lose. And some even say that people in Ukraine live better than in Belarus despite the war. So that's the opinion. But I don't think it's a mainstream opinion yet. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions is not, I think, the purely Maidan syndrome is mainly among the opposition-minded people, in Minsk especially. And some of the political leaders do express the reservations, saying that Russia might be, you know, participating somehow, or at least waiting on the sidelines. But the big question, I think, in Belarus also this different syndrome, the syndrome of past repressions. Mm-hmm. Like people,
the 2010 syndrome,
2010 and even before that. So people still, the majority would be probably more afraid to come out for pure fear of repression than for some potential Russian intervention.
Marina, what do you think? Is the Maidan syndrome dead, or is it just sleeping?
I think it's also symptomatic that Russia is always the elephant in the room.
Yes.
if we talk about Belarusian economy, politics, protests, civil society, Russia is always somewhere there, subconsciously looming over every problem. I would echo on what Alexei said, that Maidan syndrome, as you labeled it, is probably more of a notion for those who are professionally engaged in political activities. People, of course, would prefer Belarus to stay the isle of stability in the Eastern Europe, but I'm afraid that they are already poor and desperate enough to disregard this stability for the sake of economic changes. It remains to be seen how violent would be the reaction of the authorities at the end of March, and how many people will show up, and what will basically happen next. Because what we have witnessed in 2011 with the silent protests, and then several days ago, that plainclothes policemen, so basically ordinary looking people, mm-hmm. violently dragging random people, well, for passers-by. These were random people, dragging them out of a trolley bus and throwing them into a bus and taking them to court, where they're tried for actually taking part in a authorized protest. It is scary, of course, and that will inevitably also put people off.
Now, there's also what I call the reverse Maidan syndrome, the fear on the part of the authorities that if they do crack down hard, that this could lead to an explosive situation in the society, in this situation, in this economic environment, and that could be the pretext for a Russian intervention that would remove Lukashenko and replace him with a more obedient figure from Moscow's perspective. Do you see this fear on the part of that? Because I'm getting the sense, as I watch Lukashenko respond to this, I get the feeling he doesn't know what to do, because if he doesn't crack down, he could get a Maidan. And if he does crack down, he can get a Moscow-backed coup, because they could use the chaos for a pretext to that. And he's wavering back and forth between these things. Do you see this kind of uncertainty in the authorities?
I don't think that much of uncertainty. I would say authorities are doing the thing that they used to do. They know how to do it. And they probably still have a lot of resources to do it, which means to do repressions. Speaking about Russia's influence, one of my colleagues wrote a column today, and he said that we shouldn't look for a black... Speaking of those theories of conspiracy within the Lukashenko's entourage, right. But he said we shouldn't look into black cat in a dark room where there's only Lukashenko in that room. For which I say, yeah, he's probably right, but... Also, referring to that Shoigu famous saying that you shouldn't look for a black cat in a dark room, especially if it's a polite cat and well-trained, I say there's a black elephant in the apartment. Yes. But that black elephant in the apartment has been there for long, long, long time. And I think Lukashenko is doing what he used to do, because before that big crackdown in the year 2010, there had been 2 years of so-called liberalization. Yes. But the principal difference so far, the week before that crackdown, Lukashenko went to Moscow, he signed some agreements, he got some money he needed, and then he had free hands. So far, he has no free hands, but still, it does not mean that he will totally abstain from repressions. We already see. I would have to respond to one point, those people in the bus, some of them were definitely passers-by, but most of them were participants in the protest, and the authorities are definitely taking the most active people. Those were anarchists who were in masks, so the authorities used it as a pretext to arrest them. And they are arresting, as Lukashenko said, we are taking the raisins out of the cake. You should take those activists like raisins out of the cake. So that's why they're doing so far, and they would prefer to keep it this way by arresting the most active. But I think if there's mass protests, they will not stop, and they will crack crack on the protests if they see real danger.
Mm. No, we've referred to the elephant in the room, the elephant in the apartment, the black cat in the dark room. Let's talk about Russia a little bit here, because this is really at the heart of this. And we'll get into this more in the second half as well. But Russia is the elephant in the room here. And Moscow has been pretty quiet about this so far. But they're watching. But they're watching. And you have to wonder what their next move is going to be. When will it get to the point where they do think it's worthwhile to intervene? Alexei, you and I had an interesting conversation off mic yesterday where you said that both Lukashenko and Moscow basically want the same thing, but just on different terms. They want to return to the status quo. Russia wants Belarus to be a quiet and obedient client state.
Which it is.
But it wants that without giving Lukashenko money anymore.
Yeah,
and Lukashenko wants the money.
I think that's the root of a crisis. Russia is the root of the Belarusian crisis, but not in the sense that it's a conspiracy. It's in the sense that Russia does not want to give them money anymore and subsidize the economy.
Or it wants something in return for the money that Lukashenko is not prepared to give. But one has to wonder when it's going to get to the point where Russia thinks Lukashenko can't control this situation anymore. It's time to pull the plug. And the question of whether they feel they can control that transition, this has always been the calculation in the Kremlin. Is they're not going to make a move until they feel they can truly control the transition. And this is also based on the fact that the Lukashenko system cannot survive without subsidies. I mean, you have this this kind of neo-Soviet socialism here, which is financed from Moscow. And if Moscow's not going to pay for it anymore, it's unsustainable. No,
let's ask Marina.
Yeah, of course, Marina. We have to bring you into this discussion here.
Yes, just probably briefly to mention a couple of things that you were also talking about. I guess what Lukashenko's regime is trying to achieve is retaining control. So it's not that much thinking of if Russia is going to intervene, what are Russian plans. This is a home game. They have angry Belarusians against them. And it's not Lukashenko against Putin. It's Lukashenko facing angry Belarusians, basically.
But you don't see a third player in the game here? Because I think if Russia wanted to influence this situation, I think we all know they could.
Exactly. That's what I also was saying before, that we so far we haven't seen that Russia is trying to put the finger into this game. Of course, they're watching, like they were watching protests in Ukraine in 2000 at the end of 2004. But Russia has a lot of it's an economic recession itself. They have a lot of money to spend on all their military actions around the world. They have an uncertain situation with their relationship to the United States, and they ran out of money to finance Belarus. And there are also several crisis negotiations between Minsk and Moscow on this gas debt, on oil delivery. And the Belarus wants the third tranche of the loan that was already promised. And so far, Russia is busy with their own agenda and not really interfering. And I'm not convinced that Moscow is considering overtaking Lukashenko overtaking the regime if Lukashenko is failing. I'm not sure it will be that easy to install someone that quickly. And I don't think Moscow can allow itself to have another row with the West because of what they're going to do with Belarus.
I don't think it would be easy, but I also, from what I know about how this Kremlin operates, I am certain that they would not let Belarus slip out of their control, and they would do everything in order to keep Belarus in Russia's orbit.
But Brian, you're saying control and orbit. And I thought previously you were saying if Lukashenko is failing, economically, and then people turn against him, that they will then install a new person because Lukashenko cannot solve the problems of Belarus. Problems of Belarus are purely economical. And Lukashenko is also a perfect figure for Russia because he will never be good enough for the Western partners. Because he can pretend to be less of a dictator, but it's an autocratic regime. Yeah.
No, I agree that Lukashenko will never be acceptable to the Western partners, but he's also a bit of a pain in the ass to the Russians, and they view him this way. He's theirs. They feel that they have control of him, but if this slips out of his control, I mean, because what they care about is not Lukashenko, it's Belarus for a number of reasons. The geopolitical importance of Belarus has increased exponentially over the last several years. If you look at in Western military strategists recognize this as well as Russian military strategists. If Belarus looms really, really, really large in a hypothetical military conflict between Russia and the West. In fact, two think tanks just did a war game on a scenario in a conflict between Russia and NATO. And the very first thing that happened, you know what it was? Lukashenko was overthrown in a coup, replaced with a KGB general who was completely pro-Moscow and invited Russian troops in. That was the first thing that happened in a very serious war game conducted by two think tanks with top Western officials. They were gaming out scenarios. Belarus is extremely important because of the Savalki Gap. Militarily, that is huge. This is something, if Russia can plug that gap, this 100-kilometer or so strip of land between Kaliningrad and Belarus, which would cut off the Baltic states from the rest of NATO. Russia can't do that without Belarusian territory being an extension of Russia's military territory, if you will, in Russia's area denial capabilities, which really worry Western military strategists. Belarus is huge. So the stakes are really, really high here for the Kremlin on this. And they're watching quietly now, and they're not saying anything. And when the Kremlin's really silent about something that I know is very important to them, I worry.
But then, Brian, Alexei, then why Russia is not cannot continue subsidizing Lukashenko and keep him and his regime stable if all of this that what you described is at stake?
Okay. Well, I'm not totally on the side of Brian, so I won't respond to him. I'll tell you how I see this situation. Basically, it's a bugging. It's a big bugging, and there are also these red lines. So if, for example, Lukashenko or somebody else, whoever comes after he dies, jumps out of the window or replaced, thrown out by the Belarusian people, whoever else comes, or Lukashenko himself, gets out of the customs union, for example, and says that he wants to join, even not without specific plans, not the specific deadlines, but says he wants to join in perspective the European Union or NATO, for example, that would be a signal for Russian troops to get into Belarus. But with the current situation, I don't see it as preparation for the Russian coup. I see it more as a blackmail on both parts, or the game of chicken.
Yeah, we're in the bazaar.
Both sides are watching who blinks first and who first gives, some concessions in this case. Lukashenko wants money, Lukashenko wants preferences, Russia wants something in return for that.
Yeah, no,
because they don't have that much money.
We're in a lot of ways we're in the bazaar.
And when we're talking about this idea of coup, it's I see it that when and if Lukashenko does not control anything anymore, it's not, Russian instigated coup. It's just that he is not able to control Belarusian people anymore. When they see that, of course, they will try to instill somebody who will be at least as pro-Russian as Lukashenko himself.
No, I largely agree with that. I mean, we there's two metaphors I often use to describe the situation in Belarus. It's the bazaar and the video game. Right. We're in the bazaar. You're right. We're negotiating. Russia wants things. It wants that airbase. It wants Belarus's energy infrastructure. It wants a lot of things from Belarus that Belarus isn't prepared to give, but it wants the money. And we're seeing where these, and then you're right, Alexei, there are red lines. We're also in this video game. I often like to compare Lukashenko to a gamer. He's a really good gamer, but the game's getting really, really deadly now because the Belarusian people are involved in this and they don't know they're in a bazaar. They don't know they're in a video game. And so there's a couple of dynamics going on, several dynamics going on simultaneously right now that are deadly. Any last comments before we move to the next section? Because we will definitely continue with this line of discussion in the second half.
Let's continue then.
Okay. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at what we do and do not know about the inner workings of Belarusian politics. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is Alexei Znatkevich of RFRL's Belarus service. And joining us on the Skype line from Berlin is Marina Rachley of the Fund for Belarus Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Кто сменит Лукашенко?
Лавировать между Западом и Востоком.
Министр иностранных дел Беларуси Владимир Макеев.
С министром внутренних дел Игорем Шумиловичем.
Что Беларусь это исследовательская лаборатория, в которой...
How much do we really know about the inner workings of Lukashenko's court? What are the main factions and clans? If Lukashenko left the scene tomorrow, who would be the main contenders for the throne? The bottom line is very, very little. As Andrew Wilson, author of the book Belarus, Europe's Last Dictatorship, put it recently, we've become very good at Lukashenkoology, but we're not very good at Belarusology. But this week we got, or seemed to get, a glimpse inside of the black box. A report by the Mint Center for Strategic and Foreign Policy Research and an article in Belaruski Partizan allege that Lukashenko is being manipulated by a cabal of security service officials led by Interior Minister Ihar Shunevich, who are trying to frighten him into a harsh crackdown on the protesters. And in Regnum, journalist Yuri Baranchuk wrote that a faction led by Foreign Minister Vladimir Makai is trying to persuade Lukashenko to negotiate with the protesters and cozy up to the West. Baranchuk argues that Makai is scheming to be Lukashenko's successor and is attempting to undermine the Belarusian strongman's grip on power and lead him down the path of Viktor Yanukovych. Adding to the intrigue, Baranchuk was arrested in Moscow shortly after that article came out, although a court later ordered his release. Alexei, what do you make of all this?
Well, I think much of the supposed faction struggle is inspired by Lukashenko himself, and it's part of his game. There are some real differences of opinion within the Belarusian authorities, but I think they are more often based on political functions than on personalities. Mm-hmm. And I suspect if Makey becomes Minister of Interior and Shunevich Minister of Foreign Affairs, which is more difficult to think
to
of. Well, Makey has 12 years of military service in the Soviet Army after the same university. Like he's a GRU person,
right.
So I wouldn't rule out him becoming a head of KGB, for example, or head of Interior Ministry. But their roles would change, in the sense that Belarusian system needs somebody who speaks to the West and says, "Listen, guys, if you don't give us support, if you don't give us at least some money, if you don't give us some backing, then Russia will grab us." We had a very, very interesting situation a couple of years ago when there was a diplomatic meeting in Washington and there was a Belarusian diplomat there, and he was saying basically, "Listen, we have very, very dangerous neighborhood. We have this horrible neighbor who wants to basically grab us and attack us." And one of the foreign diplomats, one of the Western diplomats asked, and who is that?
Poland, of course. Lithuania.
What country is that? And that Belarusian diplomat was really, really not willing to answer that. So all factions within the Belarusian system would be pro-Lukashenko and pro-Russian, even those who speak to to the West and saying that, you know, this scary Russia wants to grab us. But, in fact, as we spoke already, Russia wants to keep the status quo. It doesn't want to pay for it. And the government understands that Russia is their real, like, real foundation of support.
And that hasn't changed since 2014, after the fears.
It has changed in the sense that Belarus is more scared. The Lukashenko is more scared of what Putin might do, and of course he's not completely. He does not feel safe, but he understands his corridor of possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
That he understands that he cannot run away from Russia.
So do you see, I mean, I understand your argument that the institutions are basically driving the what people are arguing here. And so by virtue of his position, McKay is going to naturally be the one that doesn't want to crack down on the protesters, does want a rapprochement with the West. And Shunevich is going to be the one that wants to crack down. But doesn't conviction come in here? I mean, people must have different opinions.
Well,
we're not talking about machines here. Of course.
I mean, Shunevich put on the NKVD uniform.
Right.
I couldn't
imagine McKay doing
and McKay that. Probably wouldn't do that, but again, Shunevich, you should understand the personal difference is that Shunevich graduated from the police school in Minsk, and the reason he's also part of this supposed pro-Russian faction is because he was born in Lugansk Oblast, and of course Lugansk is now has this image of Russian world. But I think basically the difference is the difference of style, and McKay served in the Soviet army for 12 years before becoming a diplomat. After that, since 1992, he has been a diplomat. So, of course, his manners are different from those of Shunevich.
Like so many, he's remade himself after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
But if you look in his eyes, it's similar to what George Bush looked at when he met Mr. Putin for the first time.
He looked into his eyes and saw his soul?
Yeah. I wouldn't look that much for a soul there.
Marina, your thoughts?
Well, I'm not a big fan of conspiracy theories, but I would probably rephrase some of the things that Alexei has already raised, that I would also see two approaches to retain control of the country. So these are groups that are interested in retaining keeping the same structures, keeping the status quo, because they benefit from them.
Mm-hmm.
They are part of the structure and they benefit from it. At the same time, what Alexei was also mentioning, they are naturally more pro-Russian because Russia is what they understand. They don't understand all these complicated structures of democratic countries, because things have to be discussed, they have to be approved, they have to go through all kinds of institutions. They don't have time for that. They want to be efficient, and they want to profit from state resources the way they have been profiting before. So, and actually, it's true that Belarusian structures of power, they are very well insulated. On the other hand, Lukashenko doesn't assign blame to somebody else. He always says, it was my decision. It was my decision that I was well informed. Mm-hmm. And well advised, but it was my decision. And on the other hand, I don't think that, you know, that Lukashenko's elder son, he heads the Security Council.
Victor.
That if we say that the military and security structures, they are plotting something against Lukashenko, it's then a revolution inside the family. And this is very, very unlikely.
Now, I'll tell you what I think I see here. I think I see... And I agree, they're both sides are trying to preserve the system. And if you take the narratives that came out of the Center for Strategic and Foreign Policy Research article and the piece in Regnum by Yuri Baranchuk. If you take these things at face value, and that's a big leap of faith, but let's just take them at face value, we basically see two factions here, one led by McKay and one led by Shunevich, who basically understand that the system as it stands right now is unsustainable because the system needs Russian money and the Russian money's not coming. Therefore, they see two ways out. McKay sees a way out of, all right, let's get what we can get from the West. And we can't get that if we crack down on these protests. We have to make peace with these protesters. We have to come to a new social contract. And we have to somehow get the West to pony up a little bit. And the Shunevich faction, which I also think that Viktor Lukashenko is part of as well, is arguing that the current status quo is unsustainable. Therefore, we have to crack down on these protesters and go directly into the arms of Russia.
Well, I think first we should reverse the roles here. If it's Shunevich group, it's probably Viktor Lukashenko group, and Shunevich is part of it.
Yes.
If there are such groups, but I don't see it that way. In the sense that I think both groups want, as Marina said, to keep the status quo, and both play their own roles in keeping the status quo. So even if McKay wants closer relations with the West, he probably doesn't see the opportunity to get that much money out of the West, although we ask the International Monetary Fund for the next tranche of loans. But these people just think that it's still possible to keep the power with minimal repressions, and by maybe cozying up to the West, it's only to get the money out of Russia. So Russia pays, believes that we go to the West, but not because they really believe that Belarus can become part of the Western structures. Because what McKay recently said, he was asked, is he afraid that the crackdown on the protesters can really influence the warming up with the West? He said, yes, it's a danger, but I believe that we should not take into account these marginal protests that much. Of course, I'm not saying that all the arrests are grounded. That was kind of very, very risky thing to say. But on the other hand, he said, you know, the Western democracies, they were becoming democracies for hundreds of years, and we only have 20 years. So basically what he's saying is we need another 100 of years, and by that time somebody will die, and yeah, we'll be dead.
Right. I mean, let's take it from another angle here too, and looking at this and this little information war that's going on, and leaving aside whether these things are true or not, because this is another thing that's interesting. I mean, the Minsk Center for Strategic and Foreign Policy Research, Belaruski Partizan, the authors of these articles, Savitsky, Tsaryuk, they have long been arguing this kind of pro-Western line in Belarus. I've been following their work for a while. And in Baranchuk's in Regnum, in Baranchuk, my Belarusian pronunciation, I keep pronouncing it like a Russian. I apologize to all you Belarusian speakers out there. I don't have good Belarusian's pronunciation. Baranchuk they were long arguing that Lukashenko's betraying the traditional ally Russia by going too close to the West, and that Russia should just take over. So we have this information war going on between these two factions. Now there are allegations that these things are connected to elements in the power structures. But what does this information war tell us?
Marina, what do you think?
You mean information war? What is happening on the Belarusian media?
We see this polemic going on this week. This week, it's gotten very intense between these articles that were appearing, accusing Shunevich of trying to force Lukashenko to crack down, and accusing McKay, on the other hand, of trying to persuade Lukashenko not to crack down. There's this conspiracy. What does this information war tell us about what's going on, if anything?
I wouldn't call it an information war, actually. Regnum is, for example, is no longer a credible resource of information, especially what comes to Belarus. I'm afraid they have their sources that leak information that is sometimes blatantly, I believe, even not true. And certain people that you already mentioned, they are discredited as analysts or journalists. What is interesting that there are several messages that come from Belarusian regime, how they explain what is actually happening. There have been this wonderful TV product of national television actually blaming Ukrainians.
Yes.
This
is in the Regnum piece is arguing that, and I would never argue that Regnum is a credible source, but I read it to get a sense of the thinking of people in certain quarters in Russia and elsewhere, because it does definitely represent a spectrum of thought in Russia and now increasingly in Belarus. But I would not call it credible, but what it says tells us something. And this Ukrainian trail has been very prominent in the pieces that have been in Regnum.
I mean, it's probably more symptomatic than anything else. Then there is also what you have been mentioning, that Russia is behind it. Or even worse, that we should not move as was it one of the senators from Mogilev who said that we should stay home and eat borscht without meat, because otherwise, if we try to protest, if the protests are massive, will attract too many people, then Russia will intervene and take over the country. What I find interesting that Belarusian intellectuals have been referring to this time as the beginning. As the end of Lukashenko's era.
The beginning
it's
of
probably
the end.
Just the beginning of his decline. It might be long and painful for the society. It might take 10 years. But as soon as you see angry Belarusians who want Lukashenko to step down, it's definitely a beginning of something very interesting inside the Belarusian society. And what you have been referring to, it's still a very elitist and probably quite marginal thinking, at least in my understanding.
Mm. I mean, I can't figure out if we're witnessing the Belarusian spring or the Belarusian time of troubles, to be honest. Alexei, what do you make of the polemic, though? We've both been following this polemic this week.
Well, I think that's basically the struggle for resources, because these people based in Moscow and based in Belarus who are writing for Regnum, this is a kind of faction within the modern Russian elites who want to be holier than the Pope and holier than more Russian world than Putin. And they're basically saying that Putin should replace Lukashenko. So they have been agitating for a coup in Belarus for quite some time.
Yes.
And that's the reason why the three guys got arrested in December.
And
that's why, yes, they asked for Baranchik's deportation. But these people are something that's part of the Russian mainstream now. And the people who are replying to them, they are part of the Belarusian elites, also part of the Belarusian mainstream. It's not some kind of outside, you know, faction. I think these people are playing also their role within the system.
So this is just Pakazuka, or this is
No. It's a real it's a real argument between polemics between part of Russian elites and part of Belarusian elites, I would say.
Okay, well, we'll be sure to keep a close... I'm sure this story will keep all of us busy in the weeks and months ahead, and we'll keep a close eye on it. We'll wrap it up with that. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been Alexei Znatkevich of RFRL's Belarus service, and joining us on the Skype line from Berlin has been Marina Rachlai of the Fund for Belarus Democracy at the German Marshall Fund. Thank you both for a lively and enlightening discussion.
Thank you, Brian.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.